The Gaia theory is good for everyone to know about, but using it requires people to have a lot of scientific information. You can't get hold of a lot of scientific information, and you don't have the education you need to see what all the information means. But the Gaia theory affects you, just like it affects everyone in the world. Your ancestors figured out a lot about it in your local area, even though they didn't have a way to figure out how it worked for the entire world. So, how can you talk about the Gaia theory without the people who are taking your farms being able to say that the fact that you don't have a lot of scientific information proves you're just a bunch of dumb farmers who don't know anything? Luckily, another great scholar figured out a way to do this. His name is Jeremy Rifkin. He wrote a book called Entropy, which is about the social and economic effects of the laws of thermodynamics. This gives us a good way to connect biology to physics. The laws of thermodynamics are the most fundamental laws of physics. That means they're the most fundamental laws of the universe. A lot of people think the most fundamental laws of the universe are told to them in their religions, but that can't be true for two reasons. First, nobody can prove that their religion has the most fundamental law of the universe because different people's religions have different fundamental laws of the universe. If two different religions say the fundamental law of the universe is two different things, they can't both be right. So, what do people do then? Fight each other? Now we have Cortez and Montezuma getting into a war again over whether people are supposed to eat wheat and peas or corn and tomatoes. Second, the fundamental laws of the universe and religions are always fundamental laws that involve people. These kinds of fundamental laws usually say things like, people must do something. But that assumes that people are the most fundamental part of the universe. What about plants? What about animals? What about rocks? What about stars? What are they supposed to do? People seem to be the most fundamental part of the universe to us because we are people. But that doesn't prove that we are the most fundamental part of the universe. That only proves that we've confused ourselves. This is another example of how humanocentrism gets people into trouble, and of how using science depends on looking at all the evidence, including the evidence that shows something you don't want to believe is true. This is also an important way that science is different from religion. Some people of some religions have figured out the same trick, but not all people of all religions. Scientists don't study the way people act in the universe. They study the way everything acts in the universe, whether people are involved or not. They discovered their fundamental law of the universe by studying what people do, and also what plants and animals and rocks and stars all do, and seeing what they all had in common. When they discovered that all of them work the same way all of the time in certain ways, those ways became the scientists' fundamental laws of the universe. I've already told you the scientists' story for how life on Earth began, and told you how you can see that story continuing in every living thing you look at. In the same way, scientists have discovered a story for how the universe began, and you can see that story continuing in everything you look at. There are four laws of thermodynamics. They are called the zeroth law, and then the first, second, and third laws. They are called scientific laws because they affect everything in the universe the same way, and they never change. Out of all the millions of things scientists have studied, from ants to the sun, no one has ever discovered anything that the laws of thermodynamics didn't affect. The zeroth law was discovered sometime after the first law, and it turned out to be an idea that the first law depended on, so it was called the zeroth law. It's an important point of reference for scientists. Basically, it says that if you have three cups of water, and one of them is the same temperature as the other two, those two are the same temperature as each other. Basically, scientists found a way to prove that in thermodynamics, 1 = 1 = 1. Scientists need to know how to prove things like that, because if you just assume certain things are true because they seem obvious to you, that's humanocentrism. Sometimes you'll be wrong, and then you'll make a lot of mistakes in whatever you're studying. I've already told you what happened when they did that with the Gaia theory. When everyone assumed the atmosphere worked the same way it's always worked, they didn't realize how much it was possible for the atmosphere to change, or how much trouble that would cause. The first and second laws are the most important for understanding how the Gaia theory works. The third law is useful for understanding how the universe works without life being involved. Perhaps you know that the Earth moves around the Sun. We can't feel the Earth moving, however, because we're on the Earth. In the same way, the Sun moves through the universe, and so do all the other stars, but we can't see that by eye because all the stars we can see are moving at the same speed and in the same direction. Scientists who study stars have a lot of big telescopes for looking at stars, and they've discovered a lot of science about how stars move. By studying how light shines from stars, they discovered that a star would give off light differently if it was moving toward us or away from us. You can see, or I should say, hear, the same thing happen if you stand by a train track while a train passes by. A train makes noise the same way anything makes noise. The parts of the train moving make the air molecules around the train move. When those air molecules move, they hit other air molecules and make them move. That keeps happening until the air molecules in your ears move, and they hit the insides of your ear and make them vibrate. Your ears are parts of your body that are very sensitive for feeling air moving. By feeling the air moving with your ears, you can tell that a train is coming. If you're standing beside a railroad track and a train is coming, or you're standing beside a railroad track and a train is moving away from you, or you're standing across a field from a railroad track and a train is passing by, the same train, the same distance away from you, will seem to make three different sounds. When the train is coming toward you, it makes the air molecules move faster. The parts of the train keep moving and making the air move. Since the train is moving closer to you, each movement of the air it causes starts closer to you than the last one did. That squeezes the movements in the air closer together. A high-pitched sound moves air molecules faster than a low-pitched sound. The sound of the train isn't changing, but the train moving toward you has the effect of making the air move faster, because each part of the train sound that reaches you starts closer to you than the sound before did. After the train passes by you, the opposite happens. Now the train has a lower pitch to you than it did when it was approaching you. Now that the train is moving away from you, each part of the train sound starts further away than the last one did. That has the effect of making the air between you and the train move more slowly. Since lower pitched sounds are caused by air moving more slowly, the sound you hear is a lower pitched sound. This is called the doppelganger effect. It really doesn't matter if you can understand all of that or not. If you can hear that trains have three different sounds, depending on whether they're passing by you at a distance, coming toward you, or moving away from you, that's all you need to understand how the scientists figured out how the universe began. The light from stars works the same basic way as the sound of a train. Scientists who study stars figured out how to build telescopes that let them measure how the light from moving stars was being changed in the same basic way that you hear how the sound of a train changes. There are a lot more stars in the universe than the ones we can see with our eyes. Stars are bunched together into groups called galaxies. All the stars we can see with our eyes are part of our galaxy. There are some faint smudges of light which you can see in the night sky that are the light given off by other galaxies. With telescopes, scientists can see other galaxies a lot better, and can see galaxies that we can't see with our eyes. When a star is moving toward you, the light gets compressed because each part of the light starts out closer to you than the previous part of the light, just like the train moving toward you sounded higher pitched. That makes the light of the star bluer than it would be otherwise. If the star is moving away from you, the light gets stretched out more, just like the sound of the train moving away from you sounded lower pitched. That makes the light of the star redder. You can't see this red or blue shift with your eyes, but scientists can build telescopes that can detect this. What the scientists discovered was that all the galaxies are moving away from a central point. The way they're moving away from each other shows that the universe must have begun with a huge explosion that shot out all the stars. They called this explosion the Big Bang. What the universe looked like before the Big Bang, no one can tell because it wasn't like anything in the universe as we know it now. What we can tell about it is that it must have been some sort of huge ball of energy which contained all the energy and all the stars in the universe. It might have been one gigantic star that was millions of millions of millions of millions times hotter than the sun. Figuring out how the universe began let the scientists figure out how it would end. Since the universe began with a gigantic ball of energy that exploded, the universe would end when all that energy spread out. This is basically what the third law of thermodynamics says. When all the energy is spread out evenly, the universe as we know it will stop. Energy makes atoms and molecules move. Atoms and molecules are always moving. When you add energy to atoms or molecules, it makes them move faster. When you remove energy from atoms or molecules, it makes them move more slowly. When atoms or molecules with a lot of energy, meaning ones that are moving fast, hit atoms or molecules with less energy, ones that are moving slowly, some of the energy gets transferred from the atoms or molecules that have more energy to the ones that have less energy. This happens because the atoms or molecules that are moving faster hit the ones that are moving slower. When that happens, the ones that are moving slowly start moving faster than they were, and the ones that are moving fast start moving more slowly than they were. You can watch this happen with two experiments. First, find two soccer balls. You could use two rocks or two of anything, as long as they weigh about the same amount. Set both soccer balls on the ground some distance apart from each other. Then kick one of the soccer balls as hard as you can and hit the other soccer ball with it. When you kick the first soccer ball, you put a lot of energy into all the molecules in the soccer ball, which made all the molecules in the soccer ball move in the same direction. You can tell this happened because the soccer ball is made of molecules, and when you kicked the ball, you made the whole ball move in a certain direction, not just half the ball or something like that. When the first ball hit the second ball, it made the first ball move faster than it was moving before. The second ball wasn't moving at all before, and when the first ball hit it, it made the second ball move. When the first ball hit the second ball, that also made the first ball move more slowly. When the molecules in the first ball hit the molecules in the second ball, the molecules in the first ball transferred some of their energy into the molecules in the second ball. This made the molecules in the first ball move more slowly, and it made the molecules in the second ball move faster. You can see this happen because both balls are made of molecules, and when the fast-moving ball hit the slow-moving ball, the stopped ball, which had zero speed, the fast-moving ball slowed down and the slow-moving ball sped up. You can try any variation of this experiment you want. As long as one ball is moving faster than the other ball, there's no way that you can make the two balls hit each other without the faster ball slowing down and the slower ball speeding up. For the second experiment, you need two pans, some water, and a fire or stove to heat them over. Chill one of the pans by putting it in a refrigerator or leaving it outside overnight. Then put the water in the other pan and heat the water over the stove or fire. When you heat the pan of water over the stove or fire, you are adding energy to the molecules in the pan and the water. that's making the molecules in the pan and the water move faster. The molecules were already moving, but you couldn't see that, because unlike the soccer balls, the molecules in the pan and the water are so small that you can't see them. Now you're making them move faster. I've already told you how you get the energy out of a fire. You use the heat of a match to break the molecular bonds in some wood to let the sunlight out. Some of that heat breaks more molecular bonds, and that lets out more heat. Some of the heat hits the air molecules above the burning wood, and that makes those molecules move faster. Then some fast-moving air molecules hit the slow-moving molecules in the pan and make them move faster. Now maybe you want to ask how the energy got into the match head to start the fire. The match head contains some chemicals that only need a little bit of heat to start burning and giving off more heat. When you strike the match, you rub it quickly against something rough. That creates heat by friction, and that's enough heat to make the match head burn. If you're trying this experiment with an electric stove, the electricity moving through the stove burner is making the atoms in the stove burner move faster. If you want to know more about how all of that works, you could ask a teacher or university student who has studied physics. This is what I mean about science and democracy depending on the same things. There aren't any questions you're not allowed to ask. Also, it doesn't matter who you ask, because the physics that make an electric stove work, or that make anything else work, work the same way for everyone in every part of the world. Anyway, with the heat energy from your fire, you make the molecules in the bottom of your pan move faster. When those molecules hit other molecules, they make the other molecules move faster. That slows the first molecules down, but then the heat from your fire speeds them up again, so they stay the same temperature instead of cooling off. Soon, the heat from the fire works all the way through the bottom of the pan. Then the fast-moving molecules in the pan hit the slow-moving molecules in the water and make the water molecules move faster. When those water molecules move faster, they hit other water molecules that weren't moving as fast. That makes the slow-moving water molecules move faster and the fast-moving water molecules move slower. But then the heat from the fire travels through the bottom of the pan and heats up the fast-moving water molecules again, so they keep moving fast. As you heat the water over the fire, you make the heat spread through the water, which is why the temperature keeps rising. Fast-moving water molecules keep hitting slow-moving water molecules and making the slow-moving water molecules move faster. This makes the heat from the fire spread through the water. If you heat the water enough, it will start to boil. When the water was cool, it looked like it was just sitting there. The water molecules were moving, but they weren't moving enough that you could see them moving. When you boil the water, you add enough heat to them that they start moving so fast that you can see them moving. You can see this happening because when the water starts to boil, the heat from the fire makes the water start to move. Now take the pan of water off the fire or stove and let it cool down for a while, until you can put your hand in the warm water without burning yourself. Then, pour half of the warm water into the cool pan. If you feel the side of the pan now, you will notice that it isn't cool anymore. Now it's warm. Some of the heat from the water traveled into the pan, because the fast-moving water molecules hit the slow-moving molecules of the pan. The water molecules slowed down, and the molecules in the pan sped up, just like molecules have been doing to each other throughout this experiment. Now, put one of your hands into each of the pans of water at the same time. You will probably notice that the water in the pan you heated over the fire is a little warmer than the water you poured into the cool pan. That's because the fast-moving water molecules that you poured into the cool pan transferred some of their heat into the pan. When the fast-moving water molecules hit the slow-moving molecules of the pan, the water molecules slowed down, which made the temperature of the water drop. The reason I told you about the soccer ball experiment first is because, as far as molecules moving and transferring energy to other molecules is concerned, molecules are just tiny little soccer balls that are so small you can't see them. The pans and the water you used in the second experiment, as well as everything else in the world, are made up of billions of miniature soccer balls. When you heated the pan over the fire and then poured the warm water into the cool pan, you heated things up and cooled them down by making all those miniature soccer balls hit each other and move either faster or slower. Everything in the universe is made of molecules. Making molecules move requires energy. Energy moves because there's more energy in one place than in another. Energy moves from the area of high concentration to the area of low concentration. You saw this in your water experiment. First, there was more energy in the fire than there was in the water, but when you put the pan of water over the fire, it made some of the heat of the fire travel into the water. Then when you poured the warm water into the cool pan, some of the energy of the warm water traveled into the cool pan. That made the water cool off and the pan warm up. When all of the energy is distributed evenly throughout the universe, there will be no more areas of high and low concentrations of energy. Energy will no longer move from one place to another, so it won't make atoms or anything else move anymore. Everything in the entire universe will stop. More recently, as scientists have learned even more about how the universe works and built even better telescopes, they discovered that the origin of the universe is more complicated than they thought, so the end of the universe is more complicated also. What the earlier scientists discovered was close, but today scientists understand more about the Big Bang. Now they've discovered that all the galaxies are moving away from each other at an accelerating rate. If the universe was formed by a simple explosion like a gigantic piece of dynamite, it should have given all the galaxies one big push at the beginning. If it did that, they would be slowing down now. At most, they would be moving away from each other at a constant rate. Instead, all the galaxies are moving away from each other faster and faster. This means that something very strange is happening in the center of the universe. It seems that the Big Bang might still be happening. If that was the case, then the universe wouldn't stop all at the same time. Instead, the oldest parts of the universe would stop, but would keep getting pushed out of the way by the newer parts of the universe. Whatever is happening in the center of the universe, even if new energy is being created, that energy will never reach us because the center of the universe is very far away, and we are always moving even further away from it. That might sound confusing and seem like an idea that's so strange there's no point in thinking about it. But that brings me to the first and second laws of thermodynamics, which is how you can watch the story of the origins of the universe continue to be told in your own house. These two laws are also two of the most important pieces of the Gaia theory, which let you see the Gaia theory working without any scientific education or scientific equipment. The first law of thermodynamics says that the total amount of energy in the universe is finite. Even if that isn't literally true and new energy is being created in the center of the universe, the total amount of energy in any part of the universe is finite because each part of the universe is moving away from the center of the universe. Even if that isn't literally true and our part of the universe is getting more energy from somewhere, the Earth is getting that new energy so slowly that it isn't changing anything Mr. Rifkin wrote in his book using the old version of the Big Bang. I should point out here that this is how science works oftentimes. First, scientists discover big clues about how the universe works and get a general understanding of how it works. Then later, more scientists discover smaller clues and refine their understanding of how the universe works. You probably learned how a farm works the same way. Maybe when you were 3 years old, you learned that farms work by farmers putting seeds in the ground. As you got older, you learned more and more about that basic idea, so you learned more and more about how to farm. Today, as an adult, you know enough about how to farm that you can run your own farm, but you probably still learn more about how to farm as time goes by, so that when you're 50 years old, you'll know more about farming than you did when you were 20 years old. If you knew everything you knew when you were 50 back when you were 20, you would have been much better at farming, but life just doesn't work that way. This brings me to the second law of thermodynamics. The second law of thermodynamics says entropy tends to increase. That's a fancy way of saying that matter and energy always move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration more than they move from areas of low concentration to areas of high concentration. You saw this happen in the water experiment. All of the heat from the fire didn't go into the water. Some of the heat from the fire went into the water, but some of it went into the air. You know this because you could hold out your hand and feel the heat from the fire making the air around the fire warm. Also, some of the heat from the fire traveled through the water and came out the top. You know this because you could hold your hand over the pan of water and feel the heat rising from the water. You started with some energy concentrated in one place, in the firewood. You wanted to concentrate that energy somewhere else, in the water. But when you burned the firewood, some of the energy from the firewood didn't go into the water. That means that the energy that went into the water was less than the energy that came out of the firewood. That's exactly what the second law of thermodynamics says, that matter and energy always move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration, more than they move from areas of low concentration to areas of high concentration. You can see the same thing happening on the front doorstep of your house. You can see it happening to your shoes and your clothes and your tools. The universe began with a high concentration of matter and energy, and all that matter and energy will keep spreading out until the universe ends. The scientist's story of the origin of the universe is being told everywhere you look. Unless the front doorstep of your house is brand new, it's worn down from where people have stepped on it walking in and out of your house. This is the same thing that happened to the stone temples in ancient Greece, where the wise old men discovered the idea of atoms. Every time someone steps on the doorstep of your house, the friction of their foot makes a few atoms break loose from your doorstep. Basically, every time someone steps on the front doorstep of your house, they turn a tiny bit of your doorstep into dust that's so fine no one can see it. That dust then gets blown away on the wind or washed away by the rain and mixes with the rest of the dirt outside your house. Or maybe it ends up inside your house and you clean it up when you sweep your floor. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's no longer part of your doorstep. That means that as time goes by, the more people step on your front doorstep, the more your doorstep gets worn away. This happens to everything in the world. Your shoes get worn out over time. So do your clothes. So do your tools. It happens the same way. Friction makes atoms and molecules break off whatever they were attached to. In every case, in the beginning, a lot of atoms and molecules were concentrated in one place. If you have a stone for the front step of your house, it means you have a high concentration of stone molecules for your front step. As time goes by, the stone molecules wear off the stone and get spread more evenly throughout the world. But there were a lot of stone molecules in one place. Now, there are a few less stone molecules in the original place, and a few more somewhere else, turned into dust. The sun is basically a gigantic ball of fire. It isn't a fire like you would light in a fireplace to make tortillas. It's a lot more complicated than that. The sun burns the way it does because a lot of atoms are constantly being torn apart and give off huge amounts of energy, which is why the sun burns at millions of degrees instead of a few hundred, like your cooking fire. This is another one of those things that you'll have to learn more about if you go to a university to learn about science. But as far as farmers who want to learn about planetary biology are concerned, the sun is a giant ball of fire. Like any other kind of fire, the sun needs fuel in order to burn. It has a certain amount of fuel, and as time goes by, its fuel gets burned up. The sun is very hot. Outer space is very cold. In the same way that mountains are colder at the top than they are at the bottom, the sky above a mountain is a lot colder than the top of any mountain. The reason for this is simple enough. If you warm two rocks by a fire, a bigger rock could store more heat than a smaller rock, so it would stay warm longer. The Earth is a gigantic rock, so it soaks up a lot of heat from sunlight. High in the sky, there is nothing to soak up heat except for tiny dust particles. The sun is much bigger than the Earth, and it's very far away. Out of all the sunlight the sun gives off, only a tiny amount of it shines on the Earth and turns into heat. The rest shines off into outer space. If you go to a university, you'll have to get into a complicated explanation at this point about what exactly heat is. But there are two basic ways you can look at this, and for what I'm talking about, it doesn't really matter which one you use. The easy way is to say that the sun is very hot, but space is very cold, and outer space is a lot bigger than the sun, so it soaks up all the heat from the sun and never warms up. That would be the same as if you heated a rock by a fire and then threw the rock in the ocean. The ocean would cool off your rock. Your rock would heat up the ocean also, but it would be by such a small amount you wouldn't notice it. The more complicated explanation is to say that the sun shines into space, and most of its light never hits anything, so it never turns into heat. Then the heat of the sun is basically tied up in light that travels through the universe forever. For our purposes here on Earth, talking about planetary biology, the easiest way to think about thermodynamics and the Gaia theory is in terms of sunlight turning into heat. Scientists have more complicated ways of talking about sunlight and heat that work well for some things, but the way I'm talking about them is the easiest way to talk about them for the things I'm talking about. When the sun shines on the Earth, it heats the rocks and the dirt and the water and all the other things it shines on. That warms up the ground, and the ground warms up the air. That's pretty simple. Now we get back to talking about something you do know a lot about. Plants. When sunlight shines on plants, it makes a lot more complicated things happen. The sunlight adds energy to the chemicals in the plants that makes chemical reactions happen that makes the plants grow. When the plants grow, they soak up nutrients, meaning more molecules, through their roots and take in more molecules from the atmosphere. Then they turn those molecules into new plant molecules, which is how the plants get bigger. The new plant molecules are large and have a lot of energy tied up in the molecular bonds. Then, if you cut down a tree and burn it, or pick an ear of corn and eat it, the energy you release in the fire, or the energy you get from eating the corn, is the energy that came from the sun. I've already told you all about this. If there were no people in the world, this is how the environment would work forever. Plants would grow from the sunlight, animals would eat the plants, other animals would eat those animals would die and be eaten by bugs and worms, and the bugs and worms would turn the animal back into dirt, and then more plants would grow out of the dirt. Everything eats something else, everything gets eaten by something else, chemicals keep moving around in the environment, and the natural cycles of the world continue. If there were no people involved, this is how the world would work until the sun ran out of fuel and there was no more energy for the plants. That would take at least a billion more years. Humans have used their intelligence to figure out how to do things no other plants or animals can do. We take things out of the natural cycles of the world, use them, and create waste products that nothing in the environment can use. An example of this is styrofoam. Styrofoam never breaks down because there are no animals in the natural world that can eat styrofoam. Also, We can take things out of the natural cycles of the environment, use them, create waste products that could be reclaimed by the natural cycles of the environment, but leave them in places where those cycles of the environment can't reach them to reclaim them, or can't reclaim them fast enough. An example of this is carbon dioxide. Smoke from factories and automobile exhaust contains carbon dioxide. Plants use carbon dioxide to help them grow. But if you create too much carbon dioxide, the plants can't use it up fast enough, so it builds up in the atmosphere. Also, if a lot of carbon dioxide built up in the upper atmosphere, high above the Earth, plants couldn't reclaim it there because plants don't grow high up in the atmosphere. Taking anything from the environment and creating waste products the environment can't reclaim uses up natural resources and creates pollution. We call this environmental unsustainability. We are taking things out of the natural cycles of the world where everything is always being used by something to help it live, and we're filling the world up with things that nothing can use to help them live. What we end up with that way is less living things in the world, because we are turning a lot of things in the world from things that living things were using into things living things can't use. If one of the people who were taking your farms planted a crop on your land that used up the soil nutrients faster than it replaced them, this is exactly what would happen. Right now, you start out with good dirt, you grow your crops, you harvest your food, and when your plants die, they rot and turn into more good dirt. The people who are taking your farms want to grow food faster. Farming that way, they will get more food, but they won't have as good of dirt next year as they had this year. Then those people will hold all that extra food up and say, "See, isn't this a much better way to farm?" But they won't notice that the soil isn't as good as it used to be. People like that are doing things like that all over the world. Before, you had good soil on your farm every year because you farmed in a way that made your dead plants turn back into dirt. Now the people who take your farms farm in a way that produces more food but doesn't create good dirt for the next year. That means they're turning more of your soil nutrients into food, hauling the food away to cities or wherever they take it. The people there eat it, and the soil nutrients never come back to your farm. The laws of thermodynamics give you a good way to talk about the Gaia theory, because in the same way that you can talk about matter and energy being concentrated in certain areas, you can also talk about them being concentrated in the natural cycles of the world. In the same way that matter and energy always move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration, they also move from high concentration in their natural cycles and into wherever they aren't as highly concentrated. The natural environments of the world are so highly evolved that there are many natural cycles happening in every local environment, so there really is no way for matter and energy to move out of high concentration in one natural cycle and into somewhere where it won't be as highly concentrated. No matter where it goes, it will end up in another natural cycle of the world, and it will be used in that cycle just like it was used in the previous cycle. Indeed, this happens constantly in every local environment. I've talked about plants growing out of the ground, animals eating the plants, other animals eating those animals, the animals dying, bugs and worms eating the animals turning into dirt, and then more plants growing out of the dirt. But I never said that the plants that grow out of the new dirt had to be the same as the original plants that grew. The plants that grow out of the new dirt could just as easily be different plants. Then different animals would eat those plants, different animals would eat those animals, and so on. So the same soil nutrients keep cycling through the world, but they move around from one cycle to another all the time. When humans get involved, they make this stop happening. Perhaps the people who are taking your farms farm this way, but even if they don't, a lot of people like them do farm this way. If you plant a crop in a field that will produce as much food in 1 year as you can get, it means you plant only that crop. That means you don't plant other plants with deep roots that can keep the soil from eroding. That means that when the rains come, they wash your topsoil out of your fields and into the river. From there, the river carries your topsoil into the ocean. Your topsoil doesn't do anything any good in the ocean. Now you have less topsoil in your field where things can grow in it, and a lot of topsoil in the ocean where nothing can grow in it. That means that when people extracted things from the natural cycles of the world and used them in a way that didn't make them return to the natural cycles of the world, those things ended up somewhere they didn't help anything to live, and you ended up with less living things in the world. There is one particular way that people are making energy move from areas of high concentration to areas of low concentration right now that's causing problems for everyone, and for some people more than others. This is the burning of fossil fuels. Coal is made of trees that died and were buried in the ground before they decomposed. Oil is made of animals that died and were buried before they could decompose. Natural gas is made of plants and animals that died and were buried, but decomposed afterwards and gave off gas that was trapped under the ground. Now people are digging up fossil fuels and burning them to get the energy out of them. The energy fossil fuels contain is sunlight that was buried under the ground. This is causing two problems. First of all, there is only so much sunlight that's buried in the ground. Now people are digging it up and burning it faster than more sunlight is being buried in the ground. That means we're going to run out of buried sunlight sooner or later. Second, all that sunlight is stored in carbon molecules. Our global environment evolved when all that carbon was buried under the ground. For our environment to continue working the way it works, that carbon needs to stay buried under the ground. When those carbon molecules are burned and are broken, the carbon atoms escape into the air. In the air, they combine with oxygen atoms and turn into air pollution. That's called carbon dioxide. That's one important kind of air pollution that's trapping heat in the atmosphere and causing global warming. With the laws of thermodynamics, you can see even more reasons that if the people who are taking your farms really did know as much about science as they think they do, instead of taking your farms, they would be learning how to plant milpas and figuring out how to plant them all over the world.